as we finish up the story of Nehemiah,
I'd like to encourage you to think about the story of your own life. We're surrounded by stories all the time, right? Movies, books, we see news stories. But the Hollywood story agenda, I think it tends to move our perspective and our expectations of what's going to go on in the story of our lives in a certain direction. So we're actually quite shocked when things turn south, when things don't go well. Either we're in denial about it, or we think, oh, it's going to happen, but it's going to happen in somebody else's story. My story is going to just keep moving on like the movies do, right? The boy and the girl are separated, and they have to overcome, but they do overcome, and they end up with this happy, wonderful life. But God gives us, in the book of Nehemiah, the story ends quite differently. It doesn't have a Hollywood ending whatsoever. And I think that's helpful for us. It could be right now you're going through a time of struggle, and thinking about the story of how this story ends could help you. But also, if you're in a good place right now, if your story is, if the scenes are unfolding in really nice ways right now, it's helpful now to think about what to do when the story does turn south, right? When you have some perspective, to think about, what should I expect from the story of my own life? How is God writing it and orchestrating it? And so I wanted you to think in terms of your story and God's story and the story of Nehemiah as we close up this book. And so Christina is going to read our final chapter. Thanks, Christina. So we're going to look at, really, does the story end like this? What am I supposed to do now? And how do I find hope here? So really, does the story end like this? We hinted about this 2 weeks ago when I pulled some of these themes from chapter 13 forward. But here's the end of this long story that's had great victories, ups and downs, but for the most part, just victorious overcoming of opposition. But it ends with, first, if you look at the people, the problems with the people, verse 10. I found that the Levites had not been paid their keep. They're not being provided, which means the people aren't tithing. They're not collecting the tithes and the offerings. So the whole structure of the temple is falling apart, and the Levites are left in a place where, well, if we can't eat and provide for our families and just have basic sustenance here, we've got to leave Jerusalem, go back to the land we had, and eke out a living there. So the people forget the tithe to continue the work of the temple. And then in from 15 on, they forget the Sabbath, right? Nehemiah comes back. So what's going on? I'm sorry. What's going on here is that Nehemiah had to go back to Susa. He goes back to the king. His time is up for a while as governor. He goes back. And then when he's able to return back to Jerusalem. When he returns, he finds these things. So he finds the tithes not being paid in order to enable the whole temple service. He finds the Sabbath being broken. They're just doing business on the Sabbath. Every day is the same. The people are bringing, from foreign countries, are bringing food in. They're doing merchandise and everything on the Sabbath. And then as well, they're finding that their intermarrying is going on. The Jews are marrying and giving their children in marriage to the nations of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And that's not an ethnic centrality thing. It's a faithfulness thing. By marrying other nations, the Jewish people are taking steps towards losing their identity, losing what had been rebuilt. And so from the people's perspective, from the people that had been at work in rebuilding the wall, rebuilding the people, they've turned away from what God was calling them to do. But as well, the opponents that Nehemiah had been fighting all along, they pop up as well. He returns, and in verse 4, we see the first of the two occasions. So now, before this, Elisha the priest, who is appointed over the chambers of the house of God, and who is related to Tobiah. If you haven't been with us, Tobiah is one of the two, one of three key opponents that have been throughout the entire book. So he prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain and frankincense and vessels and the tithe offerings. So he's prepared a place for him in the temple. He's like cleaned out a closet and said, and so one of Nehemiah's chief opponents, he's got a little outpost, he's got a little office in the very temple, the thing that he's trying to undermine. And so when Nehemiah comes back, he's like, I can't believe what's gone on, right? His these opponents that he thought were defeated, they've come back in. And then as well in verse 28, we see the other chief opponent, Sanballat. It says, one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Elisha, the high priest, was son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. So Sanballat had been trying kind of this frontal approach of discouragement, of direct attack, of threatening. And now he's gotten, he's been defeated on all those fronts. But what he's done is he's gotten one of these Jewish high priest guys to marry his daughter. So he's still trying to get influence to thwart the cause of the Jews now through a marriage alliance. And so Nehemiah comes back to the situation and he sees the people unfaithful. He sees his opponents back at work. In regards to the opponents, all last year, I was battling hornets. Throughout the summer, they'd be flying around our front deck, and I spent the whole summer with pressure washers and shovels and hornet spray, finding every single little nest they had. They had them behind the louvers. They had them actually in the lamps in front of the doorway, and I got them all. And so I thought, okay, we're fine. The hornet opponents are done with. And then beautiful day, Monday, Tuesday, David and I are hanging out in the front deck. And what do I see? The hornets are back. I don't know. They're probably looking for a place. I don't know where their home is yet, but they're just back again. And so it's going to be another summer of battling the hornets. And that's kind of what Nehemiah's got going on here. It's like, I thought I dealt with this. I thought I had gotten a sure victory here, but they've all my opponents have popped back up. So, I mean, and I've excised a few little sections out of this to make it fit, but this is the end of the book. This is how this grand, glorious journey that Nehemiah has been called on to end, right? With great discouragement, lots of the victories that were won before being eroded and undermined. And so it's an interesting thing that we need to grapple with a little bit. In some ways, there's some good things out of that. I mean, one, it helps us know historically this is a reliable account, right? Because you'd never manufacture this story. You'd never make the story end up like this if you were just intentionally trying to propagandize your cause. If this is some kind of twisted wish fulfillment, I think God's wish fulfillment is undermined as well by the way this comes together. Well, what it also helps us see is that Nehemiah goes through a full range of experiences, right? He goes through the book shows us him going, having to deal with the full range of experiences that you and I go through, right? He, in those opening chapters, he has great victories, right? He receives the call, and he goes before the king, and he asks for a huge, huge favor that could have backfired. But the king says, yeah, you can go, and you can take the lumber to rebuild the wall. Everything is comes together for him initially. And we see him battling opponents. He's tempted. He's got this ongoing problem with people trying to destroy the work. He has to rally the troops. And so all things that we go through. But as well, he's got to deal with this disappointment of the final chapter in this this book that's enshrined for him for 3,000 years, that it doesn't end well. It doesn't end the way I'm sure he wanted it to end. And so it helps us to realize that following God, a life by faith in Christ, is not about just everything going wonderfully, about everything just moving ahead and we get Hollywood endings and everything comes together. This book itself testifies that we're going to have times when, like, how did that happen? I never saw that coming. I never prepared for that. How can God let it end this way? But it does for Nehemiah, and so it encourages us to in that. So it helps us realize that the scriptures have a realistic view of life, the way that this is not ending so well. So what are you supposed to do then when everything has crashed down? So what would you feel if you return from Susa, you've had to come back, you come back and everything you've worked for has been taken away? Or you go on a long vacation, or you're away on a long business trip, and you come back and your family, your job, your family, everything is just everything you've been working for and building up has been undermined and cut down. I think we have, or another way just to think about it is, what are the first emotions that grip you and overcome you when life takes these unexpected turns and you don't get what you wanted, what you expected, what you thought you deserved, and all these things come against you? I think oftentimes we experience grief and sadness and bewilderment. And I think Nehemiah, we see some of Nehemiah having that in his prayers here. So he has prayers in verse 14 and 22 and 29 and 31. And they all start with, well, three of them start with, "Remember me." I think it's kind of him saying, "God, I don't know what the heck has happened to me. Like, all this stuff I've worked for is crashed down. But Lord, would you just remember me? Remember that I've tried hard. I tried my best in these situations." So I think just the way he begins those prayers, "Remember me," shows that he's a little out of control. He didn't expect this at all. He doesn't really necessarily know exactly how to make sense of it, how to work out the complexities of it. But Nehemiah is a man of action. We've seen that worked through and through. And so it helps us to know, to see what he did. And so if we look at the opponents first, in the opponent situation, so I think he, with the opponents, he's working with non-negotiables. He's like, "I have to do something. What do I do?" With the opponents, he at least has a clear-cut thing of what should I do. He's not sort of fraught with he's not frozen under the complexity of it. But he knows that what Tobiah and Sanballat have done is just non-negotiably bad, right? It's against God's will. And so picking up in verse 6, it says, "So after some time I asked leave of the king. I came to Jerusalem, and I discovered the evil that Elisha had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And I was very angry. And I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. And I gave orders, and they cleansed the chamber. And I brought back the vessels, the house of God, with the grain offerings and the frankincense." I think he starts with things that he knows he has to do. Right? In some ways, he comes back to this very complex situation, but he starts with, "Okay, at least I know it's an abhorrent that Tobiah has given a place in the house of God. And so I'm just going to throw everything out. I'm just going to have it cleansed. I'm going to just act without any, like, I don't need to go talk to Tobiah because I know his character. I know the problems here. I'm just going to act boldly and cleanse the situation." I mean, then we see the same thing in verse 28 and 29. There's this son who's been married to the daughter of Sanballat, and he says, "Therefore I chased him from me." Right? He just said, You can't live here. I'm evicting you. I'm deporting you. I don't care about human rights. You're gone in this situation because you've shown over and over again you're trying to thwart the work of God. And so, in a sense, he's really trying to just end Sanballat's final attempt to undermine the work that God had called him to. But then when he comes to the leaders, it's a much more subtle thing, right? He'd been part of rebuilding these people. These people had made promises to God. They'd been reading the scriptures. They'd confessed their sins. They had promised, we will be faithful in terms of tithing. We'll be faithful in the Sabbath. We'll be faithful in marriage purity. And there's probably a whole bunch of other things that they went wrong with too, but these are the critical things that are highlighted. And so in verse 11 and 17 and 25, he starts with, so I confronted the officials. Right? These are his own people. And so he's coming to them and saying, he's got to relationally work with them. And so he's saying, I can't believe you've done this. He's confronting them with what they have done wrong. And then he helps explain to them what the big problem is. So verse 11, so I confronted the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? Right? He's trying to help them see the very thing that, the most important thing of having the temple rebuilt and having security and worshiping God, you're undermining the very core of that because the Levites are gone now. The Levites can't lead us in singing and in worship services. Like last week, we saw this grand celebration. They brought all the Levites back in so they could lead them in the service. But with the Levites gone, the very structure and nature of worship is taken away and disassembled. And then in verse 17, he says, I confronted the nobles of Judea about the Sabbath. He said, what is this evil thing you're doing, profaning the Sabbath day? And then he explains to them why it's so bad, verse 18. Did not your fathers act in this way? And did not our God bring all this disaster upon us and the city? Now you are bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. He wants them to see that in some ways the very position of the walls being broken down, of them going into exile, was because they didn't keep the Sabbath. It's because they didn't honor this core aspect of worship of God. And so he's like, Don't you realize you're acting counter to everything we've done for the last months of rebuilding the wall? So we've saved all this money to get out of debt as a family, and we're saving now for college and retirement and all these things, and you decide to go start a gambling habit. Like you're the very thing that we've been trying to get out of. You've thrown us right back into. And so he's trying to help them. So he's not dismissing them. He's not chasing them out. But he's trying to help them see you're acting against the very thing that we've been working towards, the very thing God called us to. And then in verse 25, I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. So somebody asked me in Sunday school, is this going to be part of my new counseling approach? It's like, if negotiation and arbitration don't work, we pull out hair. And I made them take oaths in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters or to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or yourself. And then he brings back, again, the history of Israel and how this played such disaster earlier, verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God. God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made him even to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? Don't you remember the history of your people? Don't you remember the glory days was Saul under Solomon? David hands the kingdom to Solomon, and there's no war. All the enemies are conquered. There's great wealth. There's great worship. Solomon is given this tremendous wisdom, and all the nations are coming to Israel to hear his wisdom. It's part of the grand story of what God was doing in the Old Testament, is to draw the nations to Israel to see his light and truth. But it was marrying foreign women. It was Solomon's desire to bring all these beautiful, enticing, different women from different nations into his own family that led to his downfall. And so Nehemiah is saying, look, we've been trying to rebuild the nation and rededicate ourselves as people. This is one of the historical things that most undermines that work. And so I'm sure he was grieved and shamed over what's happened, but he finds the resources to act. But how did he find those resources to act? I mean, sometimes when you and I, when our story goes south and we're surprised by it, because we've bought too much into a Hollywood view of where our life is going, and we get sucker punched by the next scene going downhill and all these problems, sometimes we're frozen, right? Either sometimes we don't know what to do next, and we give up on it's hopeless now. It doesn't really matter whether I read the scriptures, whether I pray and seek God. It's everything's a mess now. But Nehemiah doesn't do that. I'm sure he's grieved, but I think there's a key in his prayers. Well, one, his prayers to begin with, these four sentence prayers that we've seen of him throughout the book, is one key of that he's looking to God still in terms of all these things. But there's two words in the original that I think are the key here. If you look at the prayer in verse 14, he says, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I've done for the house of my God and for his service." What looks like perhaps prideful works righteousness is something very different, I think. Do not wipe out my good deeds. The word there is my hesed. Several weeks ago, I mentioned to you that you should learn at least one Hebrew word. And so, but in Sunday school, nobody remembered that. So you need to learn at least one Hebrew word. Okay, you probably didn't think of that. We're waking up this morning. You're going to learn one Hebrew word, but the Hebrew word hesed is a really, really important word. It means H-E-S-E-D. H-E-S-E-D. It means loving kindness. It means loyalty. It means mercy and goodness. And so it's used oftentimes of, so if you think of it in terms of loyalty, it oftentimes is used between two different people to say, I've been loyal to you, or be loyal to me. But it's also used quite often of God towards us. And so it's used in verse 14 when he says, my hesed, but it's also used in verse 22. It says, remember this also in my favor, O God, and spare me according to the greatness of your hesed. So I think what he's doing is he's remembering, in spite of everything crashing in his project, in spite of, if you put it in work terms, I mean, he's been working he's been working to the bone. He's been staying late. He's been doing all this stuff, and he's not only passed over for the promotion. He's let go. He comes in the next day, and he gets he's fired. So, but what he does is he's hanging firm on God's hesed towards him. That it's God's loyalty to him, God's declared loving kindness to him, and I think is the thing that he's hanging on to in this time. And what he's doing is he's saying, Lord, your hesed to me, your loyalty to me is, that's my value, that's what I'm cherishing, that's the only thing I can hang on to. So I'm trying to be, in response to that, I'm trying to show you my hesed. I'm trying to show you what the best loyalty I can show to you, I'm trying to express to you. So I don't think it's not so much remember my good deeds. It's saying, Lord, this, look what's happened. All this stuff is crashed and burned, but I'm not going to hang on to your loving kindness to me, and all I'm going to do is I'm going to try to stay loyal to you. I'm going to respond to your loyalty to me with loyalty back to you. And so it's hanging on to the big picture of who God is, in spite of. So if you take away my worldly success, you take away even my spiritual accomplishments. I mean, kind of a parallel to this is maybe Paul, right? He plants some of these churches in Corinth and the like, and he comes back to them, and all craziness is broken loose in them, right? They're not walking faithfully with Jesus. They're in 1 Corinthians, right? There's all this sexual immorality, all these crazy things going on, and so all he can do is say, in the end of the day, all I've got is you, Lord, and your loyalty to me, and help me just to show me what loyalty to you looks like in this very, very complex situation. And so I think that's how, whether right now you're in a time where the next part of the script of your life is not going the way you want it to go, or to file away for that time when that does happen, is amongst the complexity and the loss and the betrayal and the sadness and grief of that you might experience, is what we need to do is remember that our own little story is not the final thing. Because what God has done is say, I've grabbed hold of your small story and I'm yanking it to me, I'm connecting it into my big story. And so my loyalty, and you might have had every loyalty broken in your little story, but my loyalty remains firm to you because I've grasped your story and I'm connected it to my story. And so what I want from you is as much faithfulness as you can muster. It's you don't have to figure out everything. You don't have to get an answer for everything. You just need to figure out, what is loyalty to God's loyalty to me look like right now? What's the non-negotiable that I can start to act on? And of course, the way that our little story gets connected to God's big story, the big story of the scriptures of his people that does have a great ending. Right? Revelation says there is not a Hollywood ending. There's a God working everything in history ending that's glorious, and death is destroyed, and pain and suffering and evil are destroyed and put out. But it was interesting. In Sunday school, Trey was saying, in some ways, all the little stories in the Bible end a little bit like Nehemiah. Right? There's always disappointment. Things never come about the way they're supposed to. There's always expectations for God, you've got to come and fix the situation. But it's in Christ. Christ is the one that enables our stories to be not isolated boats rocking in the waves, but to be picked up and to take in and connected into God's big story. And so Jesus is really the greater Nehemiah. He's like Nehemiah, he was in Susa, right? But he was called to Judea. And he takes on the mighty task of rebuilding a wall, rebuilding a people. He faces fierce opposition. And there's great triumphs as Jesus calls disciples to himself, as he raises Lazarus. He shows us these hints of God's coming and God's victory coming to bear. But in the end, as the people fail Nehemiah, both his opponents and God's people, so the people fail Jesus. His disciples all scatter. Peter denies him three times. And Nehemiah's opponents get the upper hand, but with Jesus, his opponents get They win, right? Here, at least Nehemiah can kick out Tobiah's stuff. But they didn't just, for Nehemiah, his opponents move into the temple that he was serving. But for Jesus, his opponents move in on himself, and they crucify him as a blasphemer. But his story was part of God's big story. He had shown God perfect hesed. Jesus was more faithful than Nehemiah, or than any of ours, than we are in our small stories. Jesus lives out hesed for his people, and God shows his perfect hesed to Jesus by raising him from the dead. For the purpose, for the mission of, so that our small stories, whether they succeed or fail, that they get connected to God's big story, folded into his big story, so that our little stories get resurrected in Jesus' big story. And so I think so we need to, in making sense of Nehemiah, we've got to think of the uniqueness of how Nehemiah's story, it was set up to be grand and glorious, but it ends with a whimper, really. And sometimes that's what we're going to experience, scene by scene in our own lives. But Jesus' life, Jesus' mission, he comes and he chooses to be oppressed, for his story to die, for his story to crash, so that his faithfulness would heal our unfaithfulness, so that he would experience great victory, and he might connect our stories to God's great victory. So as you think about your own life, your own story, think about what happens in Nehemiah, but think about Jesus' story, and then think about how that connects us to God's big story, that the hope, the victory, the glory, the resurrection, that lies there. Let's pray. Father, whether we are in a time of confusion and disappointment and our own stories going south and being on the waves of things we didn't expect, or whether right now things are good, but we know, contrary to the Hollywood story, Lord, that there will be times where we're called to suffer, where things come upon us that we didn't expect, we didn't see coming. Lord, would you help us to remember your hesed, your extreme loving kindness, loyalty to us? Would you help us to remember Jesus being loyal through his whole story crashing, and yet, and because of that, you resurrecting him and allowing our stories to be connected to yours? Lord, would you help us to treasure you? Would you help us to understand and to see what loyalty to you looks like? Even tomorrow morning, would you help us to value and treasure your loyalty to us, and show us what loyalty and faithfulness to you, when just the first steps out the door, the first steps into the office or at home with the kids, would you show us and help us to walk in faithfulness to you? And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.